On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. During our last couple of shows, we've been taking a close look at food on the screen, from gelato in Italy to farm workers picking peaches in the Central Valley. This week, we continue our series right here in Los Angeles with chef Nikki Nakayama. Nikki's restaurant, which she runs with her sous chef Carol Ida, is called Ennaka. The restaurant was featured in the first season of Chef's Table on Netflix. Here's a clip from the show.
My food is very expressive of who I am. When I'm cooking, I put as much heart into it as I can. It translates to people who eat the food, and they can sense who I am when they eat the food.
Nikki Nakayama is in the studio with us this morning. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, Evan.
How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
You were one of six chefs featured in that season, which, disclosure, I should say, for those of you listening who haven't seen it, I'm the talking head on that particular one. How did it change your life?
It changed my life in a way that we were suddenly known by 10 times more people than we originally were, if not 10 times more than that. I knew when we were filming it, before it came out, that when this comes out, it means expectation levels of their dining experience at Ennaka is going to escalate way beyond what I can even imagine it would be. Our whole staff got together and we sat down. We're like, we need to make sure that when people see this and they come and eat, that it matches their expectations and hopefully go above beyond that. The image of what one thinks of when they think of success is far from what the reality of it is.
Because I would imagine from one day to the next, the phone started ringing in a very different way, and from all over the world.
Yes. The phone reservation line used to come directly to my cell phone. And I would be very happy to take any calls from our guests, taking their reservations and talking with them. And after the chef's table came out, my phone got so hot that I had to change the system right away. So I could no longer take the phone calls because there was just so much to handle and I had to share the work with the rest of our staff.
So how do you balance the expectation of a local regular who's been coming for a long time and who never really had trouble getting a reservation to a situation where it's now a 3-month wait, a 4-month wait?
We always try to do our best. People make reservations way in advance with us, and their plans constantly change. So we always tell every guest, we'll do our best, and then we have a cancellation waiting list. There's more chances of getting that table on that day that they want than they actually think. Just give us a little time to work it out. And we always do our best to reach out, because it's very important for the guests that have been coming to Ennaka before Chef's Table to still be able to enjoy what they once enjoyed about our restaurant.
So is this a situation where you should be careful what you wish for?
On some levels, it can be. But more than anything, I always feel that life hands you things that it knows that you should be ready for. And there's always something wonderful, whether the situation may be hard or easy. There's something wonderful and educational. There's something that we can always learn from every experience that we have. There's nothing that I would take back.
And in fact, it was an image from one of your dishes that ended up being the sort of iconographic image for the series.
That was very surreal. I was like, are you sure we made that? It feels so distant from when it's in front of you and when you're making it versus seeing it plastered on a poster or when you turn on Netflix and it's right there. I was like,
so what was it? What dish was it?
A uni dish that we served with carrot curry ice cream, and marinated salmon roe.
Very beautiful.
Thank you.
You revealed that you were gay. And you sort of came out to the world in that show.
Yes, I did.
That must have been particularly difficult.
Yes. I always thought that if I could, I would just keep my personal life very separate from my professional life, because I feel that when it comes down to who I am as a person, there's only so many choices that I can make. I can choose who I become. I can't choose what I am. I used to see it as a negative thing in my life because I just can't help that that's what tradition and what my culture says. So I used to think, well, this is something that I can't change, but I can choose who I become, and everything I become will be something that will allow my parents to be proud of me. So it was a very good motivational factor to reach far and be ambitious and do something that is respectful, that my parents could not think of me in other ways, but to see this place that I've earned on my own, or if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's really interesting, very complicated, like this whole other layer. You and your longtime sous chef, Carol Ida, are married.
Yes, we are. We got married last year in Hawaii, and that was perhaps the most wonderful day of my life because we were surrounded by family and friends, and it was just a beautiful setting, and it was just, it felt like the most perfect day.
And so the two of you collaborate together on the food at Ennaka.
Yes, we do.
And I understand that now you're pushing the menu even further. What are you doing?
I've been really inspired by the whole exploration of California ingredients. I was lucky enough to travel to Japan in the beginning of 2015 and dine at some very nice restaurants there. So inevitably, it always comes up in a conversation with the chefs. I would ask them what they valued in their work. And it always came down to ingredients. Every chef that I talked to always talked about ingredients. And they always try to remind me that you have to think locally. You have to think about the travel time for products. And you have to think about how to best represent your area. That got me thinking, well, I'm in California. I live in Los Angeles. I make Japanese food. And I can't help but bring food that comes from Japan because we're making very Japanese tastes. That's in line with Japanese food, yes, but how is that in line with the kaiseki philosophy of honoring what's truly local? I was thinking, I have yet to explore what real California flavors are like. And that got me thinking that maybe I could create, possibly put a menu together that was 100% California ingredients. And the menu will be more of a special series versus something that we do as a part of our regular dinner, because I feel that when we have conceptual ideas of something, it's much nicer to present it to guests with a full knowledge that this is what the intention is, instead of surprise our regular guests with this crazy idea that I just put together. And it's like, hey.
Will you make presentations or will there be something written?
There will definitely be something written that explains the whole concept and the idea of it, because these ingredients that we're going to be using are so unlike Japanese flavors. There should be some explanation to our guests as to why they're being used and the ideas and concepts behind it. Given that we have to pay more attention to the whole California landscape and the environment and the drought, we're hoping to tie it to some sort of thing where we can give back to the community. It's part fun for me, educational for myself and our staff, and hopefully for our guests as well, but also a way of contributing to what California has to offer.
What about the seafood? I know that you bring in not all, but some seafood from Japan.
Yes, we are fortunate enough to be working with Dock to Dish, who has launched a program. It's somewhat of a CSA program, but for seafood. Dock to Dish works with a lot of local fishermen in Santa Barbara, and they bring us things I've never seen before. And it's very exciting and very challenging at the same time how to make it work. We're going to work with that part of the seafood and not use Japanese ingredients.
So remind us what kaiseki is.
Kaiseki is the most formal way of dining in Japan. It consists of multi-courses prepared in different cooking methods, and it follows a specific order that highlights ingredients that are in season and is local.
Talk a little bit more about the different cooking techniques, because that's a really important part of it, right?
Yes. So the cooking techniques showcase what an ingredient can be about. The idea being that every ingredient has a specific way that if we use certain cooking methods, it'll coax the most natural flavors from the ingredient.
Give me an example.
Eggs. Japanese people love eggs of every kind. But with the steaming process in particular, for example, in a chawanmushi, it's such a well balance of the flavors of egg and dashi broth brought together. It's such a comforting dish for anybody who enjoys this steamed egg custard. It's such a wonderful way to represent what an egg can be about.
And it also shows a lot of technique.
Correct.
Because it's all about texture.
Yes, because with the proper ratios of dashi broth to the egg, you can create different textures with the egg. Sometimes if you use a little less dashi, you'll create a more richer, more smooth texture, whereas if you use more dashi, it'll be more tofu-like, a little bit more brittle. It's all in the hands of the chef.
Why do you think there aren't any other women doing kaiseki?
I can't say with certainty that there aren't other women doing kaiseki. As a tradition in Japan, it's very hard for women to reach certain levels of success or certain levels of career success because there's so much emphasis on the role that a woman needs to play within the household. It's not expected of a woman to be the breadwinner or the one who takes care of the family financially. The role of women is to take care of the family literally by providing food and taking care of their day-to-day tasks.
So interesting. Now, when you talk about California ingredients, are you talking about shopping at the farmer's market where a lot of the ingredients and varieties are not native to California, but they've been grown here forever and we have farmers doing it really well? Are you talking about that kind of California?
Initially, I thought, well, that was probably the place that I had to start with. And then as I did a little bit more research, I found this wonderful forager, Pascal. And then I thought, I've never foraged a single thing in my whole entire life. And he offered classes, so I was so excited to know about him that I took a class with him. And it was so exciting to see the whole California landscape and all these flavors that I've never had before, or just things that were so unusual, or even flavors that I have experienced, but from a different setting.
Let's play a clip of you out foraging with Pascal Baudar.
You know that one, Nikki?
I love this one. This one Pascal brought to us, it's pineapple weed. He says it's part of the chamomile family.
Yeah, it's like a wild chamomile.
Yeah, and it's wonderful because it has flavors of pineapple.
It looks like a little pineapple, and when you have to it and eat it, it just completely tastes like a little pineapple. So it's beautiful. You use this word for plating. And
yes.
Yeah.
The zensai.
Yes. Pascal finds us these really big yucca plants, and then we pickle the yucca and garnish with a little bit of the pineapple.
Let's go for it. Let's grab some.
He showed me a plant called black mustard, and I was so amazed how the flowers tasted so much like wasabi. And I thought, I might not be able to find California wasabi root, but I can use this in place of wasabi on some dishes that I want to showcase that, oh, this is somewhat like Japanese, but it's different because it's not 100% Japanese. And that was a very exciting idea for me. I've been working with him a little bit here and there and learning about a lot of these different ingredients. And the concept being, well, what if I take these ingredients that aren't inherently Japanese at all, but I use my Japanese knowledge in cooking and put those flavors into it and see what happens.
So I understand that you have an interesting story about an acorn that you found in the forest with Pascal.
He brought us this wonderful pickled acorn, and it was part of our zensai, which is our appetizer dish. And it's very small because acorns aren't big at all. So Pascal had given us the shells that he had cut off, and they're so small, like thimble size. And we had them on the plate with the pickled acorns. And we were so fortunate to have the wonderful Paul Gasol come in and visit us.
One of the Lakers.
Yes, former Lakers. And it was amazing. When I stood up next to him, I think I reached just past his hip.
The Instagram picture was unbelievable.
So that was very amazing. And then I couldn't help thinking inside the kitchen, oh my God, I'm making Paul Gasol pick up a little acorn on this dish. What is the image like? I wish I could be there to witness this because it must have seemed even smaller in his hands.
I love that.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Nikki.
Thank you, Evan.
That's Chef Nikki Nakayama. She and Carol Ida plan to unveil their California Kaiseki menu at Anaka in August. Find a recipe from the restaurant for tuna poke on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Tune into the show next week for more stories in our Food on the Screen series. Speaking of local ingredients, let's see what Laura's excited about this week at the farmer's market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm talking with Joy Cuevas, who is a pastry chef at Luke LA, which is located in Woodland Hills. Tell us what you're looking for.
I'm looking for pluot plums. I think they're so beautiful and so colorful, and they go great in cobblers or even a little tart for summer.
And what is it you like about pluots?
The taste, but mostly the color of it. It doesn't lose its color when you bake it. It's just very vibrant.
Okay, and I think the average customer is not going to be able to tell the difference between a pluot and a plum. Can you tell the difference?
I can, because they're much juicier and they're smaller. They're not as big.
And what about the skin? Sometimes the skin gets a little tangy on a plum.
This one's not that bad. This one actually stays sweet, so that's why I like using them a lot.
And there's so many kinds of pluots, I notice, and they've got great names like Dapple Dandy and all these different names. Do you like the difference in the colors, and do you mix them? How do you cook with them?
I like the difference in the colors because you also have the green gauges. And most of them are a hybrid of a plum and an apricot. So when you bake them together, their textures, some turn to mush, but the other ones keep its solid shape, so that's why I like using them.
And what are you going to make with these?
I'll make a cobbler, a nice cobbler for the summer. Yeah.
One good thing about cobblers is, first of all, you don't have to deal with making a pie crust, which is really hard for me. And then you can use a lot of fruit. So just kind of give me an idea of how you're going to prepare the fruit, and then what kind of topping do you put on?
When I prepare my pluot plums, and I put them in a big pot, and I cook them just for like 5 minutes, just so it could start breaking down the sugars and the spices, and then I put it in the oven. And then my topping, it's my graham cracker streusel topping, which is different. I make it in-house. It's just brown sugar, flour, honey, and a little bit of ginger. And I mix it, I freeze it, and I pass it through a Robo-Coot, which is kind of funny. I shred it, and then I top it and bake it off. So when you see the cobbler, you see that there's little different ridges on it.
So you kind of pre-bake the fruit in the pan, take it out, then put the topping on, and then put it back in the oven?
Yes. So the streusel doesn't get soggy in any way.
So then when you get this thing out of the oven, is it fairly firm?
Oh, it's really firm. You don't have to add anything else to it.
And when you serve it at the restaurant, is it that way? Is it hot when you serve it?
I serve it hot with a scoop of ice cream on top.
Sounds so good. That sounds like breakfast.
Breakfast all day.
That was Joy Cuevas, and she's the pastry chef at Luke LA, which is located in Woodland Hills. It's a mom-and-pop restaurant. It's got an owner who cares a lot about making delicious comfort food, and we're glad that Joy is here at the market getting the best of the season. I'm talking now with Sean Murray, who is part of the Murray family farm out of Arvin, which is a town very close to Bakersfield. And you grow a lot of pluots. Tell us a little bit about what a pluot is and how many varieties you grow and why you grow them.
Alrighty, well, a pluot actually is a cross between a apricot and a plum. And so those originally that came from Floyd Zager. And these are things that were bred actually in Modesto, California. And that's something that he's the original guy that started crossing stone fruits. You can cross cherries, apricots, nectarines, plums, all those you can cross and make new varieties of fruit.
Okay, and a pluot is part plum, part apricot, so is it more plum than apricot?
So yes, the way you get a pluot is you cross a plum and an apricot, which gives you a plumcot, and then you cross a plumcot with a plum, and that gives you a pluot.
So when you cross a plum and an apricot and get a plumcot, it's 50-50 of the 50, pair. 50.
Exactly. And then a pluot is 75-25. And so that's how you can have all of these interesting varieties where you can have apriums, pluots, plumcots. And so there's just tons of varieties.
And you grow mostly pluots.
Yes, we grow mostly pluots because we're in a hot climate there. And a pluot's a really firm fruit. And so that's just something that we can pick while it's ripe. And then it really doesn't have the bruising or things like that.
How many varieties do you grow?
So I think in total, we grow over 16 varieties of pluots.
Okay, and are some of them still in the experimental stage?
There's a lot of interesting varieties coming out. There's some things called placotums, which is actually a cross between a plum, apricot, and nectarine. We have some varieties. We have some cherums, which is actually a cross between a cherry and a plum. So there's all kinds of new varieties coming out. There's a lot of really exciting stuff to check out at the farmer's market.
Okay, and the guy who developed them, Zager, was it just a stroke of just sort of brilliance, like an Edison moment where he decided to do this?
Well, it was one of those things where he has had a passion for produce. He's been breeding produce now for over 50 years, and it's just one of those things that it's just a byproduct of crossing varieties. These are things that he's not doing in labs or anything like that. This is direct crosses, so he's simply propagating from flower with bees, basically his mad scientist project. And he's actually the original guy that created the original Pluot.
I hope he got some royalties from
it. Oh, yes, he definitely gets some royalties, for sure.
Let's talk about how you create a new kind of a fruit.
There's male and female trees. You can have a male peach and then a female plum, and they're just cross-pollinated with bees. So some do with bees, and also some people manually do that. As you can imagine, they get the pollen, and they simply just dabble it onto the flowers, propagating them.
Okay, and then you were saying that as they try to create newer and newer varieties, they'll keep taking plums, they keep taking apricots, they keep cross-pollinating, but a lot of the fruit comes out and it's not that good.
It's just not that good. It's really one of those things where there's a lot of luck involved, because whenever you're propagating these varieties, they're not true to type. So whenever you actually do get a seed from one of those pluots that you really love, if you plant that seed, it may not be exactly the same. For a lot of these breeders, it's just trial and error and a little bit of luck.
Okay, and so again, you're going to bring in about...
We're going to be bringing in 11 to 12 varieties of pluots as they're coming in with the awesome season. With peaches, you're also going to be seeing new varieties of pluots, such as the Emerald Buttes, Flavor Grenades, Dapple Dandies. Some of these varieties, they're also called dinosaur eggs, and so these are things that are really popular with the kids.
Okay, well, and grown-ups too, like
exactly.
us. Okay, all right, Sean, well, thank you so much. We look forward to the rest of the summer.
Thank you so much, Laura.
That was Sean Murray. He is one of the Murray family farmers, and they are all obviously quite passionate about what they do. He is at the Wednesday Santa Monica, Sunday Main Street, Pico Farmers Market, and many, many markets in Southern California, so look for them by name. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Get that recipe for Pluot Cobbler, courtesy of Joy Cuevas, on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we get a recommendation for wonderful Sichuan food in the San Gabriel Valley. Maybe it's a place to take Dad out for Father's Day. That's when the show continues.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
The Mapo tofu, it comes out as scarlet as you would think, and violently sputtering and boiling. And there's a nice sort of tartness to the chili-laced broth. And the tofu is very hot and very soft. Even after you eat all the tofu, you sort of want to take home the dregs to put on your eggs the next day.
Of course, that's Jonathan Gold, food critic for the LA Times, talking about the Mapo tofu at Dongpo in Arcadia.
Which is an absolutely palatial new Sichuan-style restaurant in the Santa Anita Mall.
When you say palatial, does that refer only to size or also to sort of the luxe aspect?
It's pretty luxurious. It's a relative of the Maizhou Dongpo restaurant in Century City, which for some reason I don't love, and to the Maizhou Dongpo chain in China. I mean, there's more than 100 restaurants in Beijing, Shanghai, and other places in China. And so you think, oh, is this going to be the Sichuan Sizzler?
But?
It's not quite the Sichuan Sizzler. It's not quite the Sichuan P.F. Chang either.
You like the place in Arcadia.
Yeah, I like it. There's sometimes a line, but the restaurant is absolutely enormous. I mean, I think you might be able to fit every other Sichuan restaurant in the San Gabriel Valley inside this one and still have room left over for the banquet rooms.
What's the specialty?
Beijing duck. That's rubbed and it's air dried and it's roasted. And there's a small stage in the front of the restaurant where there are sometimes three or four chefs, each with a little table, each carving a duck.
And then how is the duck presented? Is it presented with pancakes and sauce?
It's cut into slivers. So a lot of what you're getting is just the skin with like a little bit of fat. And it's very crunchy and very delicate. And that you would probably dip just into sugar, get a couple of grains on it so you can taste the duck. There are slices of breast that have the crunchy skin attached to it. Those you'd probably roll up in a pancake. You get like a little steamer of pancakes, almost like a tortilla steamer. You'd roll that up with some bean sauce, scallions, slivered cucumber.
Okay, I need to ask you about the dipping in sugar so you can taste the duck. What's that all about?
It's a tradition in China when you have something that's sort of delicate and crispy and fatty. Sugar is one way of eating it. You know that you're in a restaurant that takes its suckling pig very seriously if, in addition to the bean sauce and the other things, you're served sugar.
It's sort of adds that high note like salt does.
Right.
What else do they do with the duck?
They do sort of a crispy duck, which I guess the duck is fried. And one thing that I like is the couple times that I ordered the duck, afterwards they gave me the carcass wrapped up to make into congee for the next morning.
That is fantastic.
You roast off a duck carcass a little bit to get some caramelization, and you boil it for an hour, and then you reduce it, and you have like a nice basic duck stock.
Were there any dishes that were chili inflected?
Well, it's a Sichuan restaurant, and you got to figure most of it has chili on it. One of my favorites was a pork hock that had been stewed with chilies and garlic, both dried and fermented, which was just wonderful. That's another dish that you eat at the restaurant and then you sort of like snack on for the rest of the week. There's a version of the dish, I think you pronounce it laziji, but it's basically Chongqing fried chicken or spicy fried chicken or fried chicken with chilies. Every Sichuan restaurant has a different name for it, which is chicken chunks that have been tossed with, you know, cornstarch and Sichuan pepper and deep fried. And then stir-fried a second time with an absolutely enormous mound of dried red chilies. It doesn't make it super hot, but you definitely feel the pungence of it. The version here is probably the most luxurious in town. It was a specialty at the old Chongqing restaurant in Monterey Park, the first sort of serious Sichuan restaurant in L.A. This one might be the best at the moment. There's a tiny bit of a glaze, and they sprinkle the chicken with sesame seeds. You're served this enormous pile of chilies. You don't even see the chicken, but it's like a treasure hunt. You just keep picking through for the chunks.
There's something about those dishes that's so satisfying. You feel like you've really accomplished something. What about fish?
It's not a seafood restaurant. I mean, you know, Sichuan is a landlocked region, but they do a really nice version of, I guess, what's usually called water-boiled fish, which is a misnomer because you think it would be bland, and it's the least bland dish in the repertoire. It's this bowl the size of a truck tire, and it's absolutely frosted with chilies bobbing in the broth, and you sort of dig into it, and you take out the fish, which has been sort of velveted and par-fried before being cooked in the broth. It's delicious.
Sounds like this is a good multi-meal situation.
It is, because the servings are so generous, there are always leftovers. It's not like there's sometimes leftovers. Everybody in the restaurant is taking them home. This is probably not my favorite Sichuan restaurant. That it's some of the smaller ones in town. Chengdu Taste, of course, and Mian, which we've talked about on the show, and Sichuan Impression. Those restaurants are a little more chefly, and you're getting things that aren't quite so straight ahead. But this is a really nice sort of special occasion Chinese restaurant in the San Gabriel Valley.
What do you mean by chefly?
By chefly, I mean a restaurant where the vision of a single person or maybe even a couple people are coming through. It's where there's a point of view that isn't necessarily a corporate point of view.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Dong Po in Arcadia. Text the words good food to 69866 to get more weekly restaurant recommendations from Jonathan. In a minute, we hear how Upton Sinclair's The Jungle changed barbecue. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country, put your old ride to good use, and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Kansas City, the Carolinas, Memphis, Texas, they each have their own style of barbecue. While debate persists on whether to sauce or not to sauce and which cuts of meat and wood are superior, Southern barbecue has remained largely unchanged over time. Yet barbecue in the Lone Star State, well, it's dynamic. The man to break it all down is Rob Walsh, three-time James Beard Award winner and member of Foodways Texas. His book, Legends of Texas Barbecue, has just been revised and updated. Hi, Rob.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. I understand that there are four styles of barbecue in the state. Tell us what they are.
The four styles are East Texas barbecue, which is largely African-American, came here from the South. The original practitioners were slaves on cotton plantations. That tradition has been handed down and it's changed, but much remains the same. In Central Texas, we have the most famous of the styles, the German meat market style. In South Texas, we have the barbacoa style, the Tejano, cooking of a whole cow head in a pit, in a pozo, as they call it, which is really the oldest style. That style was already here when Southerners arrived to farm cotton and long before the Germans came in the 1800s. And then the last style is cowboy style, which is out in West Texas. And West Texas, of course, wasn't even settled till well after the Civil War. Cowboy barbecue tends to be on a direct flame in an open pit and really harkens back to the oldest of the Southern style. It's different in that it's all beef and it's usually big cuts. There's a tradition for really giant barbecues out in West Texas. I think the Dalhart XIT Ranch Rodeo reunion is tens of thousands of people eat free barbecue once a year.
That's extraordinary. Give us a visual of what that's like. How much meat are they doing and what styles? Are we seeing like halves of steers on top of huge pits?
You know, I think the best instruction that I ever got in sort of the history of Texas barbecue are in the community barbecues, which are still celebrated in the Brazos Valley, which is where the settlers, the plantation owners, first put their cotton. And in that area, there are community barbecues that go back over 100 years. You can find old menus from some of the barbecues back in the day. And the meat that they advertised was veal, mutton, and pork, which is, I mean, was a shocker, you know, veal? So I talked to some of the old timers about it, and they said, well, back before refrigeration, you had to kill the animal next to the barbecue pit. And so we couldn't have a giant steer. We couldn't slaughter it and cut it up. So we would drive around and we'd pick out some calves and we'd have them delivered on the day before the barbecue. And we'd slaughter the calf on the spot. And, you know, we tended to go for something, you know, of a few hundred pounds. And we'd put each quarter of the calf on two giant iron rods. And a man on each side would pick up the iron rods and turn them to turn the barbecue over. They still had the iron rods. They showed me some of them. Nowadays, they use sort of a steel frame contraption with rebar with chicken wire welded on it, and it sort of forms a basket. And they use shoulder clod, which is a large cut from the forequarter of the steer instead of the whole calves of yesteryear, and Boston butts instead of half shoats, which is about a 100-pound pig. And those were the most popular for barbecue. And then, of course, they say mutton. Really, it's the same cut that's sold nowadays as lamb shoulder. But what's interesting is this is the oldest Texas barbecue. You very rarely walk into a barbecue joint these days and see anybody advertising veal or mutton. There's a couple places, particularly in areas where there's a lot of African-American customers that still sell mutton. Sam's in East Austin is one of those. And Southside Market, famous old barbecue joint, still has mutton on the menu. Around the Progressive era, 1907, and after Upton Sinclair's The Jungle was published, people just freaked out about sanitary standards, and we got our first restaurant inspections, and we probably saved a lot of people's lives with better health conditions, but we condemned the barbecue pit dug in the ground to rare occasion, because after that, all the barbecue smoking was done in smoker pits. And that's where the German meat markets came in. They already had smoker pits for sausage and for some of the famous German smoked pork cuts. So when the cotton pickers came and saw them cooking these German smoked meats, they called it barbecue. And that's sort of how barbecue went from being in a pit in a hole in the ground to being in an indoor enclosed brick smoker.
Let's talk a little bit about the significance of June 19th and what role barbecue plays in festivities.
Well, Juneteenth, as it's known in Texas, it's a Texas state holiday. It was the day that the slaves in Texas were freed, and it's still celebrated. The earliest accounts of Juneteenth from the slave narratives, there's a fellow who's quoted saying, you know, that all the slaves were free and we all got together, whites and blacks, and we had a giant barbecue to celebrate. So barbecue and red drinks like Big Red or red soda and red Kool-Aid and beans and all of those favorite southern sides were part of the earliest celebrations of the end of slavery.
Let's talk a little bit more about Texas's proximity to Mexico and that barbacoa style.
When the first cattle raisers began to cross over from Louisiana into Texas around the 1820s, they found the vaqueros already established in Texas and these giant haciendas down in the lower Rio Grande Valley. And in those communities, they would dig a hole in the ground, line it with rocks, and in that pit, after they heated up the rocks with a huge fire, they would wrap some pieces of meat that had been seasoned, and that really is a description of the Mexican barbacoa style. What is unique to Texas is that as the ranch hands later on were paid in some of the cuts that weren't marketable, they began to take the cow's head, the cabeza, and wrap it in maguey leaves and put it into that pit and then cover it up with dirt. And it would cook for 24 hours. And when it came out, it was just wonderfully succulent meat with high gelatin content. There's actually a very famous scene from the movie Giant where Elizabeth Taylor is watching them unearth one of these cow heads, and they've had it wrapped in burlap, I think. And they pull it back and she sees the cooked cow's eyeball staring at her and she faints.
Given that in Texas, barbecue is such an imbued culture, and yet you have this generation of people coming up who cook, who are skilled and sort of tend to want to push, what is that push and pull of history and modern that's happening right now in Texas when it comes to barbecue?
Well, I think it's a wonderful development. And one thing that's happening is the more our young pitmaster chefs like Aaron Franklin, first pitmaster in history to win the James Beard Award, as they push the envelope on the quality of barbecue, we also rediscover some wisdom that was lost along the way. I've seen a quote from J. Frank Dobie, the famous Texas writer, who said that everybody knows that barbecue with lots of fat in it tastes better, but the younger generation wanted their meat lean. He was writing in the 50s. So over time, people cooked brisket, and they came to favor the lean end of the brisket with all the fat cut away, but that gets very dry. And so what Aaron Franklin and Justin Fortin and all the other young pit masters have done is to go with a better quality of meat. They're getting USDA prime brisket, and they're cutting it down so that the fat cap is only a quarter to a half an inch. And then they're putting a lot of spices on top of that and cooking it till it's a crispy bark. This pendulum swings of fattier meat versus leaner meat has been going on for a century. And you realize when someone comes and does something new that, of course, you know, what they're really doing is going back to a style that had disappeared.
Give us the name of a couple of people that maybe don't get as much play as Aaron, for example. If we find ourselves in Texas, where should we go?
Well, you know, I think it's a mistake to single out these wonderful, talented young pitmasters for some sort of acclaim over places that have been here a long time. And there was just a Southern Foodways Alliance film done about a place in Beaumont called Patillo's. And Patillo's is maybe the oldest or second oldest barbecue joint in the state right now. They don't even cook brisket. Their famous dish was an African-American specialty that in my book I call Juicy Links, and I've got a great recipe for it. It turns out in the original edition I called it Harry Green's recipe. Harry Green was a great Houston pitmaster, but I later learned that Harry got it from an even more legendary figure called Joe Burney, who was an African Texan from Beaumont, who brought that style to Houston. And the Juicy Link is beef ground up with a lot of suet and a chili seasoning. So it's really hot and it's really greasy. And what you do is you get the Juicy Link and you get a piece of Wonder Bread and you squeeze the meat out onto the Wonder Bread and decorate it with some raw onion and then roll it up and eat it. And at Patillo's, they call the Juicy Link sandwich a grease ball. It's discovering this history and tasting some of these dishes that are worth bringing back is just as much fun as going to visit the new hipster barbecue joint, which are always located in our big cities.
Rob, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure.
Rob Walsh's book is Legends of Texas Barbecue. Find the second edition of his barbecue Bible wherever books are sold. Now, onto something to wash down all that queue. LA Beer Week kicks off today, Saturday. The seven-day celebration of all things malty and hoppy moved us to ask Jolie Myers to bring us up to date on the latest in the local beer scene. Jolie's the managing producer of KCRW's Press Play program, and she covers the local beer scene for LA Magazine. Hi, Jolie.
Hi.
What should people know about LA Beer Week this year? Bigger, better, more exploding than last year?
Always, and that's because the LA beer scene is exploding. We've added probably more than a dozen breweries since the last time I talked to you about LA Beer Week. The whole thing kicks off this Saturday. They call it the kickoff event. It's an outdoor beer festival downtown. You can meet all the brewers. You can try all their beers.
How many different breweries are we talking about?
I think it's going to be around 30 local breweries, and then they always get some special guests to show up to, people from the San Diego area or the San Francisco area.
Does this also mean that because people from out of town are going to be here, that there's going to be tap takeovers all over town?
So you have said my favorite delightful phrase about LA Beer Week, and that is tap takeovers. This is something that is one of the most exciting parts about LA Beer Week, because what you can do is go to your local beer bar, and they have these special things called tap takeovers, where a brewery from in town or out takes over the taps, and they bring the most special brews that they have, stuff that you can't get anywhere else but their tap rooms usually. At Beer Belly in Koreatown, there is a tap takeover with Almanac Beer, which is from San Francisco, and Smog City Brewing from right in LA, Torrance. And that's going to be a really exciting one. And there is a Beechwood Brewing and Highland Park Brewery tap takeover at Glendale Tap. So it's a nice way to try beers from different parts of the city, different parts of the state in your own local beer bar.
Yeah, you can support them. Try something new.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about the new breweries that have opened here in the past year, what are a few that you'd like to give a shout out to that we should have on our radar?
Brewery West. Brewery period West period. So brewery is spelled in the Belgian way. Ends with a J, if you're wondering. And it is not only the best brewery to open in Los Angeles in the last year, it's on basically my top three breweries in Los Angeles of all time. It's in San Pedro. It's in this really great old World War II warehouse. They're using all kinds of green technology to make their beer. They're saving a lot of water. It's a lot of classic Belgian styles done in a Southern California way, and the beer is spectacular.
What does that mean, Belgian style? In a Southern California way.
A lot of the ingredients are from here in Southern California. They have an interesting saison that has lime added, and all of the limes are from California. The Belgian beers are going to be really kind of funky, fun, lots of sours. So Brewery West is doing it in a way that I find particularly appealing. Also, Beachwood Barbecue, which has been open for a few years in Long Beach and Seal Beach, they have two locations. They also opened something called the Beachwood Blendery, and they, too, are working on funky beers and sour beers. That's opened in the last year, and those beers are absolutely spectacular.
Anyone else?
The Arts District in general has exploded with breweries. There's been four or five to open in the last year or so. Arts District Brewing is a really fun place to take people from out of town. They have like skee ball, and the beer is pretty good. They have good guest taps as well.
Are they making money?
It's hard for me to know that. They're not closing down in California and across the country. Big beer like Anheuser-Busch is coming in and buying up smaller breweries. We saw Golden Road here in Los Angeles be bought up by the people who make Bud Light back in September. Obviously, they wouldn't be buying these businesses if they didn't think that they could make money off of them. There's a lot of people who bring up this question of, are we in a beer bubble? The answer is no. Los Angeles has enough beer drinkers to go around at this point. When you look at craft beer in general in the United States, it's 12.2% of beer being imbibed. That leaves a lot of room for growth.
And it's growing incredibly fast.
That's
right. It was in 2011, it was just 5.7.
Yeah, so it's doubled in 5 years. The 12.2% is from 2015, the latest numbers that we have. I mean, doubling in 5 years, and if we're looking at exponential growth, which signs point to yes, then we're looking at a lot more craft beer drinkers in Los Angeles and more breweries to support that habit.
When we talk about LA these days, we talk about all different kinds of gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
Is that also happening in the brewery scene? Are outsiders coming in?
You bet. I don't exactly know how to feel about it yet, just like most gentrification. It's a little bit hard to parse. But when you look at medium beer, these established breweries that are still craft, but they got enough money to play with, Firestone Walker just opened a small brewery in Venice. Modern Times from San Diego is about to open a pilot brewery downtown. Ballast Point is opening a tasting room in Long Beach. Lagunitas is opening one of the biggest breweries in the country in Azusa. These are big brands that have a lot of Los Angeles drinkers already.
And then there's some from far away, like Mikkeller.
Oh, yeah. So Mikkeller, which is a Denmark-based brand, even though they're what's known as a gypsy brewer, so they brew in other people's brew houses. And I think they do the preponderance of their brewing in Belgium. But Mikkeller is opening a bar downtown. They already have one of these up in San Francisco, and it's been really successful.
What do you think about the role of the beer list in a restaurant? So much of a restaurant menu these days is like this educational document telling you about where all the food is from and mm-hmm. who the farmers are.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the beer section, and maybe not so much.
Honestly, for somebody like me who is willing to throw down some real cash to eat some great food, if I walk into a place and they have Bud Light or Coors on their beer menu, I'm out. I mean, that is absolutely ridiculous. You know, there's places in Los Angeles that have hundreds of wines on their list. And then you get down to the very fine print at the bottom of the wine menu, and they have maybe three beers on tap, and one of them is a macro beer like Coors Light. I'm sorry, what? There's a lot of restaurants that are taking craft beer seriously, and they do have pretty decent menus, and almost none of it is from Los Angeles. I'd say Rose Cafe in Venice has a pretty decent beer list of California beers and a couple local ones as well. Gelina is actually, I would say, the best place that you're going to get amazing food and also amazing local beer on tap.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Jolie Myers is the managing producer of KCRW's Press Play, and she covers the local beer scene for LA Magazine. Find a link to her piece on what you need to know about LA Beer Week on our website. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we hear from a young woman who started baking and selling vegan desserts when she was just a tween. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Fans of vegan food can get their fix today in Pasadena at the Vegan Beer and Food Festival. Clara Polito will be one of the dozens of vendors who will be selling food at the Rose Bowl. Clara became a vegan when she was a tween. Seeing a void in the vegan dessert market, she took it upon herself to start baking. It wasn't long before she started selling her goods online. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm curious to know, before you started making vegan foods, were you already a bit of a baker at home?
I don't think I was really a baker. I would do like a lot of cake mix baking and using tubs of frosting. And
so it really was becoming a vegan and realizing that your world was reduced that made you get into the kitchen.
Right.
Did you have any particular mentors?
I didn't really have any mentors. I really did kind of start from scratch. I would really just kind of look at online recipes and videos and see their methods of replacing eggs and dairy. I remember around the same time that I started baking, Chloe Coscarelli won the Cupcake Wars. So that was really cool to see.
Because she's a vegan baker.
Yeah.
When did Clara Cakes start?
About a year into my baking. After I would donate a lot of my baked goods to like animal rights organizations that were having bake sales, people became interested in ordering.
And how old were you when all this got started?
I started baking at about 12, probably started running the business at 13.
Did you have help from your parents?
My mom has been incredibly helpful through everything. Any question I have, hey, do you like this font for the card? Or like, do you think that this flavor combo sounds good? She's always there to help me out.
Your first bake stand at which you sold your goods was at kind of an unusual place.
Yes. Are you talking about the smell?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know, explain what the smell is.
It probably sounds a little funny for food. The smell is an all-ages music venue that's in downtown LA. It's always all ages, always about $5. Sometimes they have more expensive shows.
Were you the first person to sell food there?
I don't think so, but maybe I was the first person to kind of consistently have a baked good stand there.
Since you've been doing this for a while now, have you seen the vegan food scene in LA change over the last few years?
Yes, completely.
How?
It's so much more of like a casual term now, because I remember when I first started coming to LA and going to vegan restaurants, it was kind of like, okay, I'm definitely just going to go to this vegan restaurant. Now you could kind of go to any restaurant and there'll be a whole vegan menu, and people that I'll meet, people are like, well, I'm vegan when I eat at home, or I'm vegan when I go out to eat. So it's definitely becoming a more approachable way of eating.
You're seen less as a marginalized eater.
Yeah.
You started as a vegetarian when you were 5.
Mm-hmm.
Was this just self-directed, or did your parents make that decision?
It was mainly self-directed. My mom had been vegetarian for a really long time before that. And so I would kind of see her eat like tofurkey while I was eating like a burger that maybe my dad made me. And so I remember just kind of wanting to try like tofurkey and then eventually thinking it would be fun to just be vegetarian. And then as I got older, I kind of understood why it was important for me to be vegetarian.
What was the impetus for you to switch from being a vegetarian to being a vegan?
I would say when I learned more about the dairy and egg industries, I felt like being a vegetarian wasn't really enough if I was going to be vegetarian, I might as well be vegan.
So let's talk about the challenge of baking as a vegan. You have to substitute eggs and butter, which have a lot of chemical interactions mm-hmm. with the flour to make things become the texture that you want. Mm-hmm. Do you have a go-to brand for a vegan butter or do you make your own?
I use Earth Balance all the time. I haven't really embarked on making my own. Maybe I should because I use so much of it.
What are your best sellers?
I would say the Inception cookies are always really popular, which are chocolate chip cookie covered Oreos.
Wow.
Yeah. It sounds like a very like bold cookie to eat, but it really does come together well. I mean, the chocolate chip cookie dough is baked over the Oreo. They kind of get combined in the oven.
And are you using actual Oreos or are you making your own
Oreos? Oreos are vegan by default. So I just use those. Otherwise, it'd be like a $20 cookie.
That's incredible. It's like you're making a little molten cake with something in the middle.
Yeah.
That's a surprise.
Totally.
Now, I understand that you make an Elvis cake. Is that a take on his famous banana, peanut butter, and bacon sandwich?
Yeah.
So what do you use for the bacon?
For the bacon, I do a coconut bacon. And it works really well because it's kind of sweet naturally, so.
Describe how you make the coconut have those sort of deeper umami-ish mm-hmm. flavors.
I use a liquid smoke, paprika, maybe maple syrup too, to just kind of get the color throughout it and caramelize.
Personally, I'm a lover of cannoli.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of your popular desserts.
Yeah.
What takes the place of the ricotta?
I've been working on the ricotta like crazy lately. I found that using cashews, almonds, and a lot of lemon juice and water or coconut milk all combined in a food processor works really well. It's just a matter of really making sure that the cashews and almonds soak long enough. Otherwise, it's too grainy. And using enough lemon juice to get that tanginess that ricotta has.
God, that sounds wonderful. Have you started writing a cookbook yet?
Yes. It's called Clara Cakes Batter Up.
Oh, I love that.
Thank you.
Are you self-publishing or do you
no,
have a publisher?
I have a publisher, Powerhouse Books.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
We know that you're participating in the Vegan Beer and Food Festival today. What are you going to be serving?
Today we have the mac and cheese waffle.
That sounds so great.
Yeah. And then we have the peanut butter cannoli, Inception cookie, and sexy cake.
What's sexy cake?
Sexy cake is lime cake, spicy, kind of zesty, salty blueberry sauce, and then key lime frosting.
Wow. Do you serve it in cake form or cupcake form?
I'm going to do cake form.
Cakes are better than cupcakes.
It's just, it feels more like a treat, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Are there any other vendors there whose food you really love?
Blue Window is going to be there. And I love Blue Window. I hear that they're making kimchi fries, and I love kimchi, so I can't wait for that. Pizzanista will be there, and they sell my cupcakes during the week. Their pizza's incredible. Burger Lords, lots of good vendors.
What do you say to young people interested in educating themselves about where their food comes from, mm-hmm. who may be leaning a bit towards veganism?
Mm-hmm.
What are some good resources?
The internet itself is such a good resource for any recipe. And if you're a young person that's concerned about the financial part of being vegan, you could definitely cook a lot of vegetables and beans and sort of like classic vegan dishes by going to even like your local grocery store. And a lot of grocery stores are starting to carry things like Earth Balance and Veganaise and stuff like that. So it's definitely more approachable. A good movie I would recommend would be something like Earthlings. If they wanted to learn more about where their food comes from, where leather comes from. Yeah.
Well, it's been great meeting you.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for being here. That's Clara Polito. She'll be among the dozens of vendors at the Vegan Beer and Food Festival today, selling goods at the Rose Bowl. Visit our website, kcrw.com/goodfood, for more details. We'll also have a link there for you to order Clara's treats online. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com via iTunes or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many, many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress-Swanson, Laryl Garcia, Camelia Say, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.